Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Nikki, and I'm an alcoholic. I'll be your host for the month of April. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meeting every Wednesday at noon Eastern Time on this online platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast on every Friday on all podcast platforms on aagrapevine.org and on YouTube. This is an open meeting and everyone is welcome. We're glad you are all here, especially newcomers. If you're new to AA and want to learn more about our program of recovery from alcoholism, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Contact with group members will help you to find a sponsor and help you learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. This is the Grapevine Daily Quote for April 8th. I have a way to live that fills every hole my gut ever had. And that's from Listen to People's Feelings, Grants, New Mexico, from July 1980, Young and Sober Stories by Those Who Found AA Early. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a daily email at aagrapevine.org, or you'll find it on the Grapevine app every morning. This is an excerpt from this month's Grapevine magazine. And look, I get it. Power gets abused. Egos flare. I've seen people lose their minds over coffee filters. I've been one of those people. But what makes AA different from the outside world is that we have built-in mechanisms for humility. When someone gets too big for their britches, there's usually an old-timer around to lovingly tap them on the shoulder and say, "Sweetheart, this isn't Congress." Running the Circus by Brianna O. from Indianapolis, Indiana. So let's start today with a reading from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, page 174 and 175 of the fourth edition big book. By this time, I was beginning to pay very dearly physically and in hope of relief, voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times in one of the local sanitariums. I was between Scylla and Charybdis now, because if I did not drink, my stomach tortured me, and if I did, my nerves did the same thing. After 3 years of this, I wound up in the local hospital where they attempted to help me, but I would get my friends to smuggle me a quart, or I would steal the alcohol about the building, so that I got rapidly worse. This will be a two-speaker meeting. There'll be no sharing by attendees, so please sit back, relax, and listen. I love open meetings because there's no pressure. We often hear it is best to try and identify with the speakers rather than compare your story with theirs. I'll introduce our first speaker, Heather Kay.
Hi, Nikki. Thank you. I'm Heather Kay. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for asking me to speak here. Automatically, right off the bat, I want to tell you how different I am than everybody else. I want to tell you that, you might have early drinking in your story and you went in the woods and but that's not my story. So automatically, I qualify as a real alcoholic because I'm real different from you. That's what's coming up. I grew up in Happy Valley, Utah, and I grew up in the predominant religion of that place, which you can imagine what it was. And my upbringing was very unusual compared to the stories I hear of how people grow up. I grew up in that place where all my friends were one of 10. I was an only child. All my friends were born when their parents were about 19 years old. My parents were early 40s. Everybody belonged to a certain political party. My parents vehemently belonged to the opposing party, like signs on the lawn and everything. And I grew up in a 8-bedroom house, only child, that was full to the brim of stuff. My parents were hoarders. So Happy Valley, Utah is about as far away from alcohol as you can get and be American. But I grew up around all of the same cues. You know, we don't feel things here. We put things on top of it. Things, literal things. And my mother was 5 feet tall, maybe, and weighed 450 pounds. So there was a lot of instruction in this is how we deal with stuff. We put things on it. So growing up that way, I had an experience where I turned away in a profound way from the religion of my upbringing. And living in that place, there's no way to explain to people I no longer belong to this religion. I had to go. I felt like I had to go. Maybe that was part of my how different I was. Maybe I didn't have to go. But anyway, I took the first ticket out of there. It was a man. And I came to New York where he lived. And we had a family. And my drinking, really, I had my first ever drink in Czechoslovakia when I was 18. And that's a very, it was like the lights were tinkling and I was in a foreign country and it was spectacular. And I really didn't drink. I didn't drink at that point in my life like I drank later. My drinking really took off after my third child was born. My husband used to prepare a glass of wine for me at the end of the evening, and I would drink the wine, like, aren't I sophisticated? And then it used to be that maybe I'll have another glass of wine. I would fall asleep halfway through the glass of wine, and then there it is on the night table in the middle of the night. And what do you go? You're not going to waste it. You have to drink it. So now it progressed. It progressed to the point where at the end of my drinking, I was, now this isn't actually the end of my drinking. This is the beginning of my last blackout. I was in my house. The police were coming in the door with crowbars to get my children away from me. And that happened in the space of 5 years. And I was drinking nonstop. The thing that happened to me that really made my drinking around the clock was I had destroyed every relationship in my life except the relationship with my father. And my father was supporting us at the time. And he was the one I couldn't knock him out from under me, the one support I couldn't get rid of, no matter how I tried. And he died suddenly on the operating table from knee surgery. And it was like, that happened the day before Thanksgiving. We were supposed to have people for Thanksgiving. So of course I had a case of wine and I canceled Thanksgiving and I drank the wine. And I just drank like that for the next year and 2 months. Blackouts all the time with my kids 100% of the time, driving out around with my kids in the car drunk all the time, putting my kids in school in the same clothes they wore yesterday with Cheerios stuck on them because I can't prepare a hot breakfast all the time, picking them up late from school all the time. When I had my daughter, when my daughter was born, and I'm an only child, I didn't grow up around babies. I didn't know what it would be like. And I hated being pregnant. I thought there's no way this thing will come out of me and I'm going to like fall into motherhood. It just didn't make any sense to me. I just hated it. It was like being a science experiment. And when she was born and I looked at her, I've never been so high. It was like being in the presence of God and I could not mother her. So I drank like that and I destroyed everything around me. And you know how we do. And eventually it was suggested to me that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't being suggested that I go a lot of places at that time. So I went and checked it out and I thought, isn't this cute? And, you know, I sort of had that attitude like, this is so cute for alcoholics. You know, I'm glad I know about this in case I ever run into one. But I definitely wasn't an alcoholic. And then it got to the point where that was really the only place I could go. And I collected 3 24-hour coins because I was in that place you talked about in the reading, the jumping off place. the place where to continue drinking was impossible, but there's no way to stop drinking. So I collected the 24-hour coins, and I would get a few days or a couple of weeks, and then I would go out and get another 24-hour coin. And then something happened to me. I do not know what it was. It was that drunk. It wasn't that day, but that drunk where my kids were being rescued from me with crowbars and policemen. That drunk lasted 8 days. That was New Year's Eve with the crowbars, and my sober date is January 8th. They took the kids for the night, but the kids came back the next day, and I have no recollection of anything that happened until January 8th. So that's how my kids lived with me. January 8th, I went into the meeting, and something happened where all of a sudden, I wasn't at a meeting of all of these strange people who were alcoholics. Now I was an alcoholic in a meeting that could address my recovery. And I really, I like talking about that is the day that I became an alcoholic. And as soon as I became an alcoholic, it got much easier to manage my drinking. I came out of that experience with all sorts of court mandates, and I wasn't working at the time. So I started banging out these court mandates, and I was going to a meeting a day, and that was a lot. And I'm taking my kids around with me everywhere because I'm the only parent that they can be around because they can't be around him because he's an alcoholic. And I was sort of doing it, and I'm going to a meeting a day, and I'm doing all the things. When I became an alcoholic on that day, it became very clear to me that I have to, they're talking to me. They said, get a sponsor. They meant me. They said, pray. They meant I have to do that. They said, go to a meeting a day. They said, you have to engage in the steps. They said, you have to call another alcoholic. And I started doing all those things like it would save my life. And it did save my life. And it saved my children's lives. It didn't save my life. It gave me a life. When I was growing up in Happy Valley, Utah, an only child, very different from everyone. The only thing I ever felt was different than you. It was impossible to be me. It was impossible to sit in a room with my friends and feel in any way comfortable, to feel in any way like I belonged, any place. There was this innate wrongness about me. Alcohol helped me with that problem, the impossibility of being me. Alcohol made it so that I could be in a room with you and I could talk to you, and somehow the barrier between me and you went away and I felt a part of. But then the alcohol would wear off, and when I would look around after that, I had set something on fire or, destroyed a relationship that was impossible to bring back, or so I had the experience of living in a way that felt possible. The problem was it destroyed everything around me. Then alcohol brought me to the point where I really had you can go on drinking or you can go to AA. And something happened on that day and I went to AA. And I found out in AA, sitting around in the chair, that I could have another experience. I could have another way to experience a possible life, the possibility of being in a room with you and not being overwhelmed by me. Oh, what is he thinking of me? What does she think about my shoes? Does she notice my shoes don't match my pants? Does anyone notice I didn't shower today? Like all these, just me all the time. And sitting in the room every day, it slowly came over me. I did all the things. I got a sponsor. I engaged in step work right away, like it would save my life. But it sort of slowly came over me that, this is about me. This is about removing the obstacle between me and you. And the obstacle between me and you is me. You're not the problem in my life. I had to find out. I found out that in a profound way in my step four experience. In, remember the experience with the crowbars? After that experience, a judge in front of me wanted to take my children away from me, if you can imagine. And that judge went on my resentment list, and I talked about him with my sponsor. Like, can you believe this judge wanted to take my kids away from me? And she looked at me in this way. You know how sponsors can look at you. That I knew what she was about to say is coming from a place where she loves me, but she's going to give me some truth now. And she said, Heather, that judge did make a mistake. He should have taken your kids. And I knew it was true. And at that moment, my life became my fault. It's not your fault anymore. It's me. And that's a wonderful thing, because that means there's something I can do. And what I can do about my life is step work. To the extent that I've been able to surrender my will to God in my step three, my life has exploded in just wonderful ways, in ever-increasing ways. The problem that was always present in my life is that there was too much of me in it. And once I drank alcohol, the amount of me went away. It got less, and I could be in a room. Once I did the steps, the amount of me that's in the room goes away, or it lessens. There's still a lot of me here. I'm still thinking, what do I look like on the screen with the light coming in the window? But it's less. It makes it possible for me to be here. So the thing I love to share lately, this feeling of it being possible to be in the world, is something I never felt. I didn't feel it when I was a child. It's not like I felt it and then alcohol ruined it. It's like this feeling I have that there is a way for me to exist with you is entirely due to me destroying my life through alcohol. The only way for me to get here in this place of possibility is through alcohol, because I had to drink alcoholically to get to the rooms and do the steps. So that's, to me, where I'm at right now, is I'm an extremely grateful alcoholic. And that means I'm grateful for the experience that alcohol gave me. And I'm grateful for the experience of my recovery. And I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to you for asking me to speak, Nikki. And that'll do.
Thanks so much, Heather. I'm fortunate to call you a friend, so thank you. And I'm also fortunate to be able to identify with so many of the things. I, too, am an only child. I think it's a special club. So you get to go to AA and then join the special club of only children. It's a very bizarre feeling. And I grew up with a family who fixed their problems with stuff, too. And it's so funny how we can be a million of us trying to get and stay sober, and how much we can identify with each other. So I can't wait to have our next coffee together. Thank you, Heather, for sharing. And just so everyone knows, she played a little joke on me this morning when I sent her reminder and said, I'll see you today. She said, oh, that's today, and then sent me back something saying she was only kidding. So that's the kind of people I like in my life. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group should be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix. You can find it on AA.org. Grapevine does not accept direct contributions, but of course we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store on your phone. You can also purchase Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By doing so, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and your local office. You can also visit the Grapevine online store at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message Project allows you to help us help others by providing magazine subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our other weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour, which is available for free on all podcast platforms and on aagrapevine.org. Please follow Grapevine on Instagram and YouTube, too. The new season of Our Primary Purpose, the official podcast of the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous, is available. In its season two, it takes listeners on a journey across the fellowship, celebrating milestones, exploring how AA reaches anyone, anywhere, and shares stories that highlight the impact of service, self-support, and recovery in action. Tune in to hear how AA's message continues to reach those who need it most. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform so you can catch every episode. It is my pleasure now to introduce Arnold R.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Heather, for a wonderful talk. And Nikki, thank you very much for inviting me to participate. I was unaware that it was going to be only child's meeting, but I'm happy to report that I am a member of that club. The Arnold story, I never know where to begin with the story, but let me just share with you that in 1944, my father was sitting in high school graduation, and he looked out in the audience and he saw my mom, and he liked it. And they began to incline with each other. And over a period of years, he got around to asking her to be his bride. And we were living in Durham, North Carolina in those days, and I'm a Durhamite. And my mother, they got married in 1950, and right around this time, 1951, my mother got pregnant just before the initial General Service Conference. And I tell you all these stories only because it's amazing to me after all these years how my life has changed with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was unaware that it was going on while these things were happening to me. I was born in December 15th, 1951. And Lord and Carrie Ross produced a 10.5-pound baby boy that evening. And because of my size, there were to be no more children to that union. And they had to make a determination that night whether they're going to save my mom or save me. And my father says, "You know, here we are." And I grew up in a household with loving parents in Durham. And my mom was a nurse, and my dad was working out at the university on a master's degree and in a laboratory. And I spent a lot of time with a grandmother who drugged me around with her like I was her purse. But nevertheless, I was loved as I remember this. And I remember being somewhat devilish in those days. And my grandmother had a neighbor next door, and Miss Patty had a huge house. And when you're 6 years old, everything is huge. And I was over there playing, and Miss Patty had cats. And I discovered that I could toss the cats off the second floor and they would hit on their legs. And I was doing some of that. It was a discovery. And Miss Patty says, "Arnold, could you come downstairs?" And I went down. She said, "Get your coat on." And we walked all the way down her walk and over one house and up to my grandmother's house. And she rang the bell. And my grandmother opened that door and looked at me as if, "I'm going to kill you when Miss Patty leaves." So Miss Patty knew that look on her face and says, "Bessie, Arnold is a wonderful boy, except the cats are tired of playing with him." And my grandmother, fearing the worst, said, "Arnold, why don't you go get ready for lunch?" And as I was leaving her, She leaned into Miss Patty and says, "Pat, you have to give Arnold. He's nothing but a blank, blank, blank starter." And that was her way of cursing. And over a period of time, not to want to make my grandmother, you know, out of a lie, I turned into that person. In 1966, about the same time that our General Service Board grew to 21, my parents moved to Baltimore. And I went to high school here in town, and we moved into a neighborhood where you could recognize, we were the only Black family in the neighborhood. And I ran around with a bunch of guys, and no problem. And we went to a dance one Saturday night. And I was nervous. As an only kid, I was always told that I was going to grow up and be somebody at some later time. But I assumed that that wasn't going to happen right now, so I had time to work it out. And I went to the men's room with that dance, and then some guys were standing around, plastering around a flask. Now I walked into that bathroom, unable to dance, and after a few hits from that flask, I came out like Fred Astaire. And I was able to socialize with everybody and be a part of the dance. And that lasted for about, I guess, 15, 20 minutes. And then I was outside, you know, throwing up all my food from earlier. And they scuffed up my shoes and took me to my home and rang the doorbell and split. And my parents opened the door, and there their son is drunk for the first time. And they didn't know anything about drinking, you know, and so they sent me upstairs to go to bed, because I told them that I'd been to a party and, you know, I had a tuna fish sandwich and upset my stomach, and they bought that. And however, the next day, the phone rang at our home, and my father answered, and there was a couple of girls on the phone saying, "We speak to Arnold," which was new. And they wanted to have some fun, because I was a wonderful person that night before. I couldn't remember anything I had done. But I realized that this alcohol thing might be something to do. Well, over a period of time, that became my reason for living, and managed to get out of high school and got down to Atlanta to college, and then left Atlanta in 1973 with a bachelor's degree, and came back to Baltimore to work. And interestingly enough, in 1973. Alcoholics Anonymous published a millionth copy of the big book, and they had a ceremony and gave that millionth copy to Richard Milhouse Nixon. He probably didn't read it, but that's besides him. That's beside the point. A million copies of the book were out there. And I went to work at an organization, a major depository in downtown Baltimore, and I found people who drank the way I did. And at lunchtime, while other bankers would go maybe to eat lunch or whatever, my friend Michael and I, we would go drinking. And Michael sat one cubicle over from me. And every afternoon, we would have on suits and ties, and we would sit out at this construction project. We were building this building around us. And my friend Michael was disgusting, because he would buy a pint of Mad Dog 2020 and drink it right out of the paper bag. And it was like he had never seen any TV. He never seen James Cagney or Sidney Poitier, them guys drinking out paper bag, but that was his deal. So I would not make him feel bad. I would get a pint of Calvert Extra and a Lily Cup and some ice, and I would join it. And we did that for like years, up until 1977. And one morning, we were sitting in our cubicles, and the phone rang on Michael's desk. And I could hear the conversation. There was a woman from personnel asking him to come down to her office, to talk about his drinking. And I couldn't stop laughing, because the first thing I'd heard all morning until the phone on my desk rang. And when I answered it, it was her asking me to come down with him. So when we got down to her office, I made sure that he went in first, because she called him first. And I pinned my ear to the listening post to see what the conversation was. And she said that the bank was no longer prepared to tolerate his drinking, and they had made arrangements to send him someplace for 30 days. And she stopped and she called me in, and she said, "Arnold, would you be so kind as to take your friend Michael up to treatment. Here's the address. And I said, of course, I'll do it after work. And she says, no, can you do it at lunchtime? And I got angry at Michael, like, you want a favor during my drinking time? But at any rate, I got Michael in the car. I drove up to Belair, Maryland, and I slowed the car down. I know I didn't stop it, but long enough to toss his suitcase up on the curb and to tell him lovingly, since you can't drink like a man, go in there and get it fixed. And I drove off to go drinking. Well, my friend Michael was blessed that at this facility, members of Alcoholics Anonymous would bring the message in to the residents. And my friend Michael heard the good news and he got sober and he came back to work and he wanted to see his friend Arnold sober, because he realized that this was working for him. And every afternoon around, I guess, 20 or 5, he would lean into my cubicle and say something sickening like, Arnold, I love you, man, and your drinking is killing you. Why don't you come and go with me to AA meeting? And I would say, Michael, you've been a little tight with this AA thing. I'm heading down to do some serious drinking. Why don't you come and go with me? But Michael was undeterred. He just kept at it every afternoon until one day I decided to go to my first AA meeting in 1977. The reason I share that is because at my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, there was an aisle down the center, and on both sides there were chairs. And on one side of the room, the people were like members of Alcoholics Anonymous that you've seen everywhere. They were sitting up, going up, sobered up, and Michael sat with them. On the other side of the room, however, people were drugged up, throwing up, cutting up, and I sat with my people. And I managed to get that chair in the back of the room and decided I'm not listening to anything they were going to say until the meeting started. And this woman, she had about 6 months, and she was happy and pleased. And she passed to another old time who had a year and a half. And there was a guy up front, his name was Willie. He said, during the beginning of the meeting, he did have Nikki's role, don't interfere. If you have questions, come up and ask them after the meeting. And I couldn't wait, because I didn't see the reason why anybody would want to quit drinking. I was 25 years old. Well, I went up to talk to Willie. And Willie said something to me that he hurt me. Willie looked at me and said, you're new, aren't you? After he got my name. And I said, yes. I didn't know how he knew that, because, you know, I didn't have on a sign, but he knew. And he knew because, like in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we see people, we look in somebody's eyes and don't see anybody at home, that's a tell. And so Willie asked me a question that in 1977 proved to me that I belonged to AA, but I wasn't prepared to do anything about it. Willie asked me, Arnold, when was the last day you lived on the planet and didn't have a drink of alcohol? And I stood there in front of Willie, and I went back in my memory banks, and I found that day in my teens, and I was 25. Now, all of us have seen a copy of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a Powell that says peace, and then there's a dash, and then there's an unmanageability piece. And the reason I tell that story is because I lived in the dash of that first step for 5 years. During that 5 year period, life has a way of coming along if you drink the way I drink. Because we've come to understand, at least for me in this life, that between two mountain peaks, there's always a valley. And in that 5 years, I spent a lot of time in the valley trying to climb the next peak. But the good news is that if the mountain was smooth, nobody could climb it. And over a period of that 5 years, things happened that drove me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I had to tell my friend Michael, who was always asking me to come to AA. Willie was his sponsor. Michael and Willie were reading that basic text. And when they got to that place in the book where it says, if you're working with somebody and he don't want what you have, you need to let him go. That's what Michael did. However, Michael was kind enough to continue down that page, and he began to work with my mom and dad. My friend Michael, for 5+ years, would go over to my parents' house and take them to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's some Al-Anon on the off chance that maybe one day their son would need this program. In May of 1982, my mother had her annual Mother's Day dinner. When I went over to the Mother's Day dinner, my father opened the door and said, I can't let you in because your mother can't stand to see you die this way drinking. And I can remember the anger of having my father say that his only son was not welcome in his home. And I very dramatically spun on my wheels to storm off the porch. And he says, Arnold, but come around back. I'll get you a plate because like you might be hungry. And my father and I ate downstairs together in silence, people upstairs having a good time. And when I finished eating, my father said, Arnold, I need the keys to this house because when we come back, sometimes things are missing from here and we won't go through that anymore. I spent the next month drinking at them. And on June the 19th of 1982, my last day drinking, I got a phone call that Saturday morning. It was my father, and he was inviting me to go to church with him and my mother that next day because it was Father's Day. And my father said it was also his birthday, and he wanted to know if I would come to church with him. And of course, I'll attend, but unfortunately, my Saturday nights were spent drinking. And that Saturday night I went out and I don't know about anybody on the meeting, but I had blackouts when it first came out. And I started out in this jazz club drinking Scotch whiskey, and my shades went down and came back up, and I was in another part of town with a beer mug, and that's bluegrass on stage. And then my shades went down again, and I was at another place drinking green cream de menthe, and I had been there so long that my lips and tongue were green. And then the rest of it's in a police report. But I came through that Sunday morning rather than being able to go to church. I came through to the serenade of In a Drunk Tank, Arnold Ross, You Made Bail. And when I walked out of that cell and looked up the tier, there stood my mom and dad and my friend Michael. And they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous after being brought back here, I stepped in to get a cup of coffee at the AA meeting, and there was a man who remembered me from my previous times at this other meeting, my first couple of meetings years before, and he stepped in next to me at a coffee urn and said, Arnold, I'm going to be your sponsor because you're too stupid to get one. And I didn't know that anything had happened, but I was in that phase of my recovery, which was the God save me phase. And I found myself, rather than punching him in his face, because you don't talk to me like that, to saying, thank you very much. And his name was Wayne. And Wayne, and he brought his sponsor to the party. And we began to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. They were able to convince me, and this is a big ask for drunks like me, that I was worthy of giving myself a gift that only I could give me, and that's the gift of a sobriety date. Now, I like Nikki and I like Heather, but they have their sobriety date and they can't have mine. I got to get my own. And they convinced me to get one. June the 20th, 1982 was it. And over a period of time, they convinced me that I needed a sponsor, and I was able to ask. And Wayne was able to guide me to a home group, and I was able to ask to be a member by signing my name. And this group that I'm a member of, I've had the same group for all these years, was where recovery process really began. Because I came to understand that I've been looking for brothers and sisters all my life, and here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got 2 million of them. And I ain't leaving because they're here. 1984, I've been 2 years sober, and we had a business meeting at my home group. And I went to the men's room. I came back. I was a GSR. I guess that's how they elected them. I surveyed the room and I realized that, yeah, they got the rag. Yeah, I'm the person for that. And I went to my first area assembly in 1984, and it was in Waldorf, Maryland. And I haven't stopped going to them since. I was blessed to be able to go to the assembly and be a GSR and be a DCM and become a part of the panel, and as the area secretary, then area chair, and be elected area delegate. I'm a panel 46 delegate from Area 29, Maryland. It was 1996 that I fell in love with this thing called service and general service. And through that process of being involved in general service, the idea of something, and I want to share it now because Nikki likes to hear these stories, called A Slob's Guide to Spiritual Progress. And that's been my road to the happy destiny all these years. So if you have a subscription to the Grapevine Digital Archive, please look up the story. Slob's Guide to Spiritual Progress is pretty simple. It's that having a sobriety date, a home group, a sponsor, a service position, and all that's really good, but you need to wrap around that a power greater than yourself to keep all that together. And that's what's happened to me all these years. I rotated in 1997 from being a delegate, and I realized that Grapevine has asked all of its past delegates to be the GBR reps of their area. And when you saw me, if you didn't buy a subscription, I would beat you to death, or I'd buy you one, whatever. I understand, and I've understood for a long time, that Alcoholics Anonymous has two corporations, one publishing old volumes and to us to write articles and subscribe to it and participate in it, whatever. And I'm a board member, a non-trustee director, and I interviewed, came one in 2000. And I was blessed to be on the board and serve in that capacity. And on the way to doing that, I had an opportunity to be a general service board as a trustee and rotated in 2007. And I just love the magazine and what it stands for and all those things. But through the period of time, I came to understand that my best thinking got me here, and I need to discard some of my best thoughts, and I need to become a worker among workers. And that's been the process and that all these years that I find myself involved in. And, you know, again, Nikki was kind enough to ask me to come speak. And that's what I hopefully wanted to share with some of those experiences. But I hope that I stopped talking before you stopped listening. Thanks, Nick.
Oh, thanks, Arnold. You know, it's always great to hear people's story. And my favorite line of all that you said was, "I'll drink this so that you don't feel uncomfortable." That was my story. That was me. I didn't want anyone else to feel uncomfortable, so I joined the fun, you know. So I really appreciate both of you being here today. Please let your friends know about our meeting. It's an open meeting, so it's also ideal for friends who want to learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep this in mind when doing cooperation with the professional community or public information work. I'd like to invite Heather to end the meeting with her choice of closing.
Thanks, Nikki. Let's end with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you all for joining us for the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Please join us again next week, and it wouldn't be the end of my time today if I didn't say, have a great day.